From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, UFOs. Here's what's happening. Members of the White House Corona Task Force clashed over new lockdown orders in California. Now, Dr. Anthony Fauci saying state officials didn't have any choice, but Admiral Brett Geer arguing that the evidence and the science simply does not support shutdowns, calling them counterproductive as the cases of COVID-19 surge in California. Governor Gavin Newsom has imposed a strict stay-at-home order over the weekend after the state fell below 15% capacity in intensive care units. Newsom warned last week that the lockdown would be triggered regionally when ICU capacity dipped under the level. The new order, the most restrictive since March, would close hair salons again, bars, indoor dining, and allow retail to operate at only 20% capacity, among other restrictions that would last for 3 more weeks covering the Christmas holiday. I'm telling you, I don't think these shutdowns work at all. More than half of the New York City firefighters say they will not get a COVID-19 vaccine when it becomes available. Approximately 55% of the 2,053 firefighters said no when the union, the Uniform Firefighters Association, simply asked them, will you get the COVID-19 vaccine from Pfizer when the department makes it available? The responses comprise about 25% of the union's 8,200 active members there. After almost 70 years, Swedish furniture giant IKEA is scrapping its iconic catalog. The company will no longer produce print and digital versions of the book. It's been touted as the most widely distributed publication in the world, and more copies of the catalog are printed each year than the Bible or the Quran. IKEA's decision to scrap the catalog didn't come lightly. The company collected extensive customer feedback, it said, and decided to focus on its online store instead. IKEA has seen a significant shift in consumer behavior thanks to the digital boom. In 2019, its online retail sales grew 45% worldwide. Our expert on the internet, Lauren Weinstein, with us. Here we go again, Lauren, a sign of the times.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly interesting. I mean, obviously, they're not the first company to do this, and no doubt they won't be the last. I mean, on the other hand, even with all the market research and everything else that these companies ostensibly do, there are firms who have underestimated the utility to customers of their printed catalogs, and in some cases have actually started printing them again. And one of the things about this is that obviously if you don't provide a non-internet method for persons to buy your products, other than coming into your store, and not everyone's able to do that, it can easily be seen to suggest that you're simply not interested in selling to anyone who isn't either near your stores or to people who either choose not to use the internet or who don't have ready access to the internet at all. And that latter group, by the way, is about half the world's population that don't have ready access to the internet. So even something that seems as straightforward as printed catalogs, especially when you're talking about a global enterprise, compared with going all online, has more complexities than you would think at first glance.
You remember the days, Lauren, when Sears had its catalog and its booming stores and everything?
You know, when I heard this story today, I was thinking about when I was a kid. You know, I used to love going through those big, what were they, 3 inches thick, right?
Yeah,
they
were huge.
Those Sears catalogs, and I just loved when those showed up in other catalogs. But again, there are companies that still do have catalogs. Some of them are specialty electronics. And clothing and things like that. So catalogs aren't dead yet.
All right, my friend. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet. Can't forget Pearl Harbor Day. Officially, the U.S. death toll in the December 7th, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor is 2,403. But the books have yet to be closed on identifying the available remains of more than 150 of those killed on what President Franklin D. Roosevelt called the day that will live in infamy.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
On the 79th anniversary of that attack, the remains of four more soldiers from that horrible day have been identified, including two brothers, the Trapp brothers of Indiana. My gosh, they were 24 and 23. Chuck Yeager, the historic test pilot portrayed in the movie The Right Stuff, is dead at the age of 97. The legendary pilot and retired brigadier general became the first man ever to fly faster than the speed of sound. That was October 14th, 1947. 97 years old. A cure for blindness could be on the horizon after a team from Harvard Medical School reports they successfully restored vision loss due to glaucoma in mice. Scientists achieved the feat by turning back the clocks of eye cells using a cocktail of proteins. It is the first time the complex tissue has been reprogrammed to an earlier age. Amazing. Clinical trials are set to start within the next couple of years. The groundbreaking technique is expected to work just as well in humans and may also conquer other neurological diseases, including dementia. And science, when it does it well. Prominent Israeli professor and retired general Haim Ished has claimed that Israel and the United States are dealing with aliens who do not want to be identified because humanity is not yet ready. That's an amazing story. He was the father of Israeli security programs. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen.
Hello there, George. And as always, space is the place. And we begin with China's latest lunar spacecraft. Pronounces the Chang'e 5.
Say that again.
You know, George, if you look around the internet and check, so many people are getting that wrong. And I tried to prepare for the show to make sure I tried to pronounce it right as Chang'e 5. And it's been making news. The spacecraft, of course, landed on the moon in the northern region of the Sea of Storms, known as Oceanus Procellarum, in a very interesting area known as Mons Rümker, that on December the 1st. But the four-module Chang'e 5 was launched back on November the 23rd. But the descent module, this is interesting, soft-landed and collected some 4.5 pounds of lunar material. Then it blasted off on the moon on December 3rd and was in lunar orbit 6 minutes later. But the fun begins. After having done that, the ascent stage then completed a docking with the orbiting spacecraft, and that happened on Saturday at 4:42 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to now bring home some of the youngest lunar samples. These may be only 1.3 billion years old compared to the older rocks that are much older. And then back to the Earth, well, we think about the last lunar samples that were returned from the moon, George. That was the Russian Luna 24 in August of 1976. Big news in astronomy and sad news. The iconic Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico is no more. After a series of mechanical failures, the final collapse of the 900-ton instrument platform came crashing down on the large 1,000-foot dish below. The instrument platform was some 490 feet above the dish, now a total loss to the radio astronomy world. It was actually completed back in 1963, and it was the largest single-aperture radio telescope in the world for 53 years, until the Chinese fast radio telescope, of course, was completed in 2016. The loss is personal, not only to scientists, George, but to the people of Puerto Rico. These citizens were so proud, and they should be, the science that Arecibo gave the world. And many of it, this particular radio telescope, was considered by many to be one of the seven wonders of the world. Arecibo made appearances in the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, and also, George, in the James Bond film GoldenEye. Arecibo will be missed by many. We wrap it up, of course, with the live sky, what people can see. The moon now wanes and continues this week to go on to its new phase, when a rare total solar eclipse will be visible for observers in far South America. Most, of course, many will miss that. But for all of us, George, as we wrap this up, the beginnings of the Geminid meteor shower are underway. The moon will not be in the sky toward the weekend. This is probably one of the best meteor showers of the year. Start looking now, as you look into the evening sky after midnight, into the northeastern part of the sky, maybe upwards of even 50 or more meteors on the evening of the 13th and the 14th, just before dawn. It could be a great show. And finally, George, Jupiter and Saturn, this conjunction continues to heat up. Look low in the southwest at sunset. now Jupiter and Saturn are about a degree apart. That's on the 21st, when they'll be a tenth of a degree apart. Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. Emails, we love them, drskyshow@gmail.com. And for all this information that we talk about SkyWise in the live sky, theskylive.com. I'm your navigator on the highway to the heavens. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and Happy Hanukkah. We'll see you next week.
Absolutely. Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. In a moment, constitutional lawyer Jonathan E. Moore joins us. His latest work, which comes out in a couple months, is called The Authoritarians. And we're going to talk about your rights. Do you have to get a mandated vaccine, for example? Will that happen? Jonathan E. Moore, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our special guest for the next couple hours, Jonathan E. Moord, principal of E. Moord & Associates. He practices constitutional and administrative law in Washington, D.C. before federal agencies. He's the only attorney in history that has defeated the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, 7 times in federal court. 6 times on First Amendment grounds. He began his legal career as an attorney in the Mass Media Bureau of the Federal Communications Commission during the Reagan administration. Jonathan, welcome back, my friend.
Thank you, George. It's actually up to 8 now, George.
Good for you. Another victory.
Yes, sir.
I love it. Hey, did you have a great time on that Chicago Health Freedom Expo Zoom that we did a month or so ago?
Oh, I loved it, and I thought you did a great job, and I thought everybody on the panel did a wonderful job. It was very informative, and I think it's still posted on their website. You can still hear those lectures. And
it was different for me. You know, I'm so used before a studio audience where I get that immediate feedback and reaction. Doing it on Zoom was a little strange for me, but we had great people like you who carried the ball for us, so thank you for that.
I think you pulled it off, George. I really do. And the comments coming in from people, they're just overwhelmingly positive, so I
great.
Think it worked very well.
You've got a book coming out next year called The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty. We're going to be talking about a lot of that tonight. Get you back when the book comes out as well, Jonathan. But I want to ask you about the COVID vaccine. And two things. One, pharmaceutical companies are exempt from being sued in case anything goes wrong, aren't they?
That's right. There is a fund that is established, but there are high hurdles to prove your case to the satisfaction of the government in order to get paid. This is an old fund. It's been around. The drug industry actually opted for this to reduce their own liability. So they're largely shielded from liability. And they argue that's necessary for them to expend the resources to develop vaccines, and they argue that vaccines are not that profitable. But, of course, that's certainly not the case with the COVID vaccine.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one company alone offered to get us 100 million doses for like $1.9 billion, which is unbelievable.
Right, and they've been paid enormous amounts of money from the federal government to under Operation Warp Speed to get those vaccines up and running. So there's no shortage of cash going into the drug industry these days.
If you as a company are immune from lawsuits because of things you may do, tainted vaccines, any mishap, doesn't that make you kind of rush things to market a little too soon to make money, knowing that you can't get sued?
It certainly diminishes your concern about adverse effects. So you might be more concerned about adverse effects, certainly, if you would be held liable for them. But your interest in preventing adverse effects necessarily is diminished by virtue of the fact that you're protected from liability.
Now, can government mandate that we all take vaccines?
Well, arguably they can under the Jacobson decision and the subsequent decisions interpreting it in federal law. But as a fundamental matter, if we are to interpret the Constitution correctly, we should hold that under the 14th Amendment, actually under the 5th Amendment here, if it's a federal mandate, 14th if it's a state mandate, that it's a deprivation of individual liberty without due process of law. To have a universal mandate, I think, necessarily violates the Constitution. That has not been the holding of the courts, unfortunately. They've largely deferred to the government in health and safety areas, regardless of the level of justification since the Jacobson decision was handed down many, many years ago in the early 1900s.
Here's my question for me, because I travel a lot, Jonathan. Can individual private airlines or publicly held airlines, whatever they may be, can they mandate that you can't get on a plane without a vaccine certificate?
They could do that. They could certainly do that. A private party has the ability to restrict individual access to its property or to its services based on its own determinations. Now, that may raise contractual questions. It may also raise questions of discrimination, but they would be novel. And I think that the likelihood is that the Jacobson line of cases would be very influential here, and they would be recognized as exercising a property right. I think, however, they risk severe public reaction to such a move. I think a lot of people, even if they are vaccinated, probably would find it a bit draconian, because if you can do it here, you can do it in any number of cases, of course.
Absolutely.
Related to health.
Absolutely. That's the one thing that concerns me. I mean, I don't plan to take the vaccine unless I'm forced, kicking and screaming and dragging. And again, on this program, John, I do not tell people to get vaccines or not to get them. That's their individual decision that they have to make for themselves and their family. In my particular case, I don't think I can't remember ever having the flu shot, and I don't remember getting the flu. I have an immune system based on many of the supplements you and I have been taking over the years that boosts my immune system to a point where, knock on wood, so far so good.
Well, if you truly believe in constitutional rights and the founding fathers' perception of the relationship between the federal government and the individual, you would not endorse any mandates from government that people be vaccinated. And the reason for that is simple. The government is not designed under our Constitution to deprive people of their liberty rights solely because of an emergency. I don't care what it is. You have to protect those rights in an emergency. That's when they're actually at stake. And your right to decline a injection of any kind ought to be well protected. And what we should know is that the proper role of government is simply to supply information. We should make a decision. That is certainly true in all areas of First Amendment jurisprudence. It is up to us to make ultimate determinations. The argument in the First Amendment context, for example, by the government has been that people will make wrong decisions if they're fully informed. And that's a paternalist view that likewise translates well over into the vaccination context, and it's repulsive to the core values of our Constitution. We are sovereigns. We should be able to determine whether or not we're going to be injected with something. And we should be free to decide one way or the other, and we should be fully protected in our decision.
Absolutely. Now, masks aren't as invasive as a vaccine, but that's pretty similar, too, where they're forcing people to wear masks, right?
Well, that's true. And, again, private parties have the ability to require those things.
That's right.
But really, it ought to be a determination made by each individual. And, you know, there are instances of assault that are prosecutable privately. So, for example, if someone knowingly gets on an airplane and they have COVID, they are obviously endangering other people. And that's an assault, just as if you were to have, say, AIDS or something and were to be profligate in your sexual life. That would be an example of an assault or gross criminal negligence, and it's prosecutable, and justly so. But when people are respectful of others and they keep their distances and they choose not to interact, if they choose not to wear a mask for one reason or another, that should be their own choice.
Absolutely. There was a couple, as a matter of fact, last week taken off a plane because they got on and they had COVID. Now, I don't know how the airline knew they had COVID, but they yanked them right off, John.
Yeah, and that's appropriate. They posed a threat to the other people on the plane. If anyone were to have contracted COVID on that flight, then, of course, they'd have recourse against those people for that.
And, of course, The Authoritarians, which is coming out in Feb of 2021, deals a lot with our rights. And we will talk about that when we come back in a moment, John. Since you've been fighting for rights for companies and individuals, have you ever seen it this bad in all your career?
No, we are really at the barricades right now, those of us who believe in liberty. And it's really a trying time for this nation. We will either survive it or we will be fundamentally transformed into a government and a system that is directly a threat to our daily lives, enslaving us, essentially.
That scares me. John, we'll be back in a moment. We'll take calls with you next hour on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Jonathan Emord. Jonathan, this assault on our individual liberties, why is it happening at such a pace right now?
Well, it actually is overt in that you see it now, but it's actually been occurring really since the antebellum South, believe it or not. The origins of authoritarian views largely arise from the philosophy of George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. Hegel's collectivism or socialism was actually the philosophy adopted by advocates of slavery in the antebellum South, who repudiated the Declaration of Independence and its four cardinal principles. All men are created equal. We're endowed by our Creator with unalienable rights. Just governments secure these rights, and just governments depend on their powers coming from the consent of the governed. They rejected all of those things to defend the institution of slavery. And thereafter, this philosophy survived the destruction of slavery and became the predominant academic viewpoint in the progressive era, when academics from all disciplines went to Germany in large numbers and were trained in Germany under the Hegelian school of historicism. They came back to the United States and they repudiated the Constitution in educating youth in college and in law school. And that generation then arose as the bureaucrats to fill the administrative state. The administrative state was actually a German creation, again, out of Hegelian theories. Bismarck's Germany created an administrative state, and these academics were educated in it. And they were educated to believe that the Constitution was archaic and needed to be rejected in favor of the administrative state. The administrative state then is the embodiment of authoritarian principles, which effectively deny individual rights to life, liberty, and property in favor of submission to a governing will imposed by the state. It is this type of draconian thinking that I describe in the book The Authoritarians. I might mention this too, George. For your listeners, if they're interested in obtaining that book when it first comes out, if they go to authoritarians.info, they can put their name and email address in there, and as soon as the book comes out, they'll be sent a link to acquire it.
Okay. Okay, and I assume it's almost done. It is done physically, right?
Oh, it's done. It's being produced, and you can see the cover of it at authoritarians.info. It's just going to actually physically be available all over the place in February of 2021.
These administrative agencies that run parts of government, I mean, who gave them the approval to run wild with all these stepping on our individual rights?
Well, this occurred in the late 1880s with the first administrative agency, the Interstate Commerce Commission, and that became a model that was then replicated during the New Deal with hundreds of administrative agencies, and they produced the vast majority of laws. But the fundamental difference between administrative law and judicial law through the courts, the federal courts, is that your rights have virtually no protection in the administrative context. You, for example, are presumed guilty until you prove yourself innocent in an administrative court when the question arises as to whether you violated a rule. That's obviously the opposite of what happens in Article III courts. And also in administrative courts, you never quite know what your charges are because they can change them. The government can change them throughout the proceeding. So you have no ability to defend with security because you don't know what you're ultimately going to be charged with violating. Also, there's no independent judicial review. The judges are appointed by the agency. Moreover, the prosecutor is the ultimate judge. It's the agency that's a party, so it's a prosecutor against you. It's also the party that ultimately decides your fate, and there's no justice in that. And then they also have general warrants. In the courts, general warrants were held unconstitutional all the way back in England. And here, general warrants persist in the administrative context, and those are warrants that are not obtained from a judge based on proof of probable cause, and they have no limitation on the scope. So an agency can send a warrant out and ask for absolutely anything it wants.
Jeez.
And there's biased discovery in favor of the agency. You have no discovery rights against the agency. The agency has ample rights against you.
It sounds like it's got more power than the court system.
Oh, it has more power than any part of the entire government. You have no right to a jury trial in an administrative hearing. You have no right to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and evidence. You have no power to obtain meaningful judicial review because under this doctrine called Chevron, the courts have broadly deferred, actually have deferred even before that since the 30s, to the findings of fact and conclusions of law of the agencies. So you're stuck in a universe once you're in an administrative court that is dead set against you and results in determinations against you that are largely unreviewable.
Interesting. Now, we have one of our guests, Dr. Jerome Corsi, who has filed a petition with the Supreme Court, Jonathan, to overturn the election because he believes it's fraught with fraud. Now, can an individual, he's not a lawyer, can an individual actually do that? He filed it, then they stamped it. They've got it. I don't know if they're going to do anything about it. But what he wants is the election to be nullified, and then the House of Representatives vote for the president. And then he's convinced Donald Trump would get reelected that way and that the Senate would probably pick Kamala Harris and tip that way. But would the Supreme Court actually look at something like that?
The court does not have original jurisdiction over that matter. In the first instance, it would have to be filed in a lower federal court. And the first question that arises is whether the person has what's called standing, that is, the right to sue. He has to be personally injured by it. Now, he might well have that based on voter standing.
Right.
But the court he would have to file in the first instance would be a United States District Court.
So he may have filed in the wrong place.
Yes, probably.
Interesting. And why hasn't the president's attorneys jumped in at this point in the Supreme Court? That hasn't happened yet.
Again, they have to pursue their actions in the lower federal courts. Now, they can leapfrog above the lower federal courts based upon novel questions or certification to the Supreme Court by the courts. But in the first instance, they have to present their case in the district court, and that's what they've done. And they've also presented their cases in the state courts. And many of these questions of election fraud are really ones that concern state law,
right,
the application of state law to the facts rather than federal law in the first instance.
I mean, he swears up and down that Donald Trump's going to get reelected, and I keep saying, I don't think so. You know, Joe Biden had his 79 million popular votes, and the Electoral College meets soon, and I think he's going to be the president on January 20th, but we'll find out who's right.
Right. I think, obviously, if there's a question of fraud, and there's extensive evidence out there of potential fraud, it needs to be brought to the courts. It needs to be fully vetted. Everyone on both sides of this political question should agree to that, because the integrity of our system depends upon ascertaining in the first instance whether there was fraud of any kind, whether it overturns the election or not, in order to ferret it out and to ensure that in future safeguards can be in place.
Here again, COVID has played around with the election, too.
Certainly has. A lot of these mail-in ballots really are dubious, particularly in California, for example. By using mail-in balloting, it's really a very dangerous thing. You can't verify the votes, and there has been a lot of evidence of parties abusing that is, collecting large numbers of ballots and filling them in and sending them in. And then ballots were oftentimes counted that arrived after the election date, and that raises serious questions about whether they should have been taken into account or not, and whether there was selective counting. But in any event, all of that, I think, will be addressed, I would hope, in the litigation that's being brought.
Jonathan, if you had a number of restaurants that came up to you and said, look, they've shut us down because of COVID, we think that's wrong, they don't have the right to destroy us, what would you do if they retained you? How would you go after government?
In the first instance, I would see whether or not this is based on a gubernatorial decree, governor's decree, rather than a product of law in the state legislature. Ordinarily, these edicts have come from governors who are abusing their power, and that violates the separation of powers. Governors have no power to shut down industry without the passage of legislation in the first instance from the legislature, yet they've been proceeding apace doing that across the country, and that is a violation of the state constitution and the separation of powers doctrine.
So you think that these restaurants probably have some grounds here to fight back?
I certainly do. And I also think that when you get into the substance of it beyond the separation of powers doctrine, the government here is depriving people of both their liberty and their property rights without due process. So there's a due process violation because they have not proven in any instance that the specific restaurant is a causative factor for spread of the virus. I mean, if you could show that people were acquiring the virus from gathering in a restaurant, you would have a basis to proceed. But the state is issuing a prior restraint, saying no restaurants, no hair salons, et cetera, even when those restaurants and hair salons have undertaken measures
to ensure that there's
little, if any, chance of spread. And so destruction of people's property and their livelihood cannot occur in this country if we respect the Constitution, unless, of course, we go the authoritarian route. But I'm hopeful that people will remember our Constitution and will sue in defense of it against these draconian measures by the governors.
These authoritarian the ways that we're headed, is it just as bad as what China's doing and what Russia might be doing now?
It certainly is. These are the same measures. In the end, everybody, you know, Karl Marx was a student of Hegel. Hegel's authoritarian model is the one that is being driven into our country by these various actions that are unilateral and unconstitutional. Those who want to bury the Constitution in favor of all power to themselves are a great threat, and they come about whenever there's a crisis, but there's never been more of them now in government and in the administrative state. We're looking at a mass takeover of the private sector and a deprivation of people's rights. And this is the underlying theme of slavery. Karl Marx was a student of Hegel. Karl Marx developed communism out of Hegelian doctrine. Communism is simply a manifestation of it. You're on the spectrum of authoritarianism, whether you're a far-left progressive, a socialist, or a communist. You don't believe in people's individual rights. You don't believe that individuals have sovereignty. You don't believe in the Declaration of Independence, its preamble, the theories that underlie our Constitution. You reject utterly Lockean principles that define our republic. You don't believe in a republic. So really, the administrative state in America is a bureaucratic oligarchy operating outside of the Constitution. The heads of administrative agencies aren't elected. They're appointed. So they are not based on the consent of the governed. The agencies have virtually no limit to what rules they can adopt. There's no separation of powers. They have legislative, executive, and judicial powers combined. There's no justice in that. James Madison described that co-location of power as the very definition of tyranny. We were rebelling against that. The whole idea that you could adopt law without having representation for it was the basis for the cry against taxation, no taxation without representation. Yet all bureaucratic law, all law created by the agencies, is precisely that, created without representation. And that represents, George, well over three-quarters of all law that governs us is now administrative law, not the law created by those we elect.
Jonathan, L.A. now is under a 10 p.m. curfew. Is that constitutional?
Curfews are difficult things, but it makes absolutely no sense here. Why is a 10 p.m. curfew necessary? I could see it if there were rioting in the streets, if there was violence and so forth. Yes, there might be a need for an imposition. There may even be a need for martial law. There may be a need for invoking the Insurrection Act on the federal level. But when it comes to a contagion, you mean to tell me that after 10 p.m. people are more apt to get COVID virus than before 10 p.m.? What about at 9:59?
Yeah, COVID goes to sleep after 10 o'clock, right?
Yeah, this is wholly arbitrary. And it's, again, an executive order that applies to everybody, that has an indefinite duration, that must have been the subject and proper constitutional means would have been the subject of debate in the legislature and the subject of law. But again, we have no say-so in this process. We have a dictator in the form of the governor who's insisting upon this being the law, and that's authoritarian. This is perfectly in line with Hegelian thinking, and he has good friends in slave owners in the antebellum South who argued against the Declaration of Independence, against the Constitution, precisely based on the same idea. In the end, it's this. They presume to know better than we do what's in our own best interest, and we cannot allow that to happen in this country.
Why isn't anybody pushing China, where I believe this originated, I'm convinced of that, in a viral lab in Wuhan? They must have had some kind of antidote or vaccine or something ready to go, don't you think?
Well, I think, you know, it's very hard to determine without all of the facts, but piecing these together, this is my theory. My theory is that they were developing biological weapons in the Wuhan lab, which is a military lab.
And we were helping them. We were working with them.
We were assisting in the funding of them. In fact, Dr. Fauci was a principal advocate of it.
That's right.
And so you have this development of this virus to be used to be ultimately weaponized, and they had, as we knew many, many years ago, inadequate safety measures to prevent that from being transmitted to the population from their people. They just simply didn't have decontamination measures that were adequate. And so I think it was inadvertently released into their own population. That having happened, they then weaponized it in a secondary sense by limiting travel within the country from Wuhan, within China from Wuhan, but leaving open international travel so people infected could go around the world.
They flood the gates. They flooded
and
the gates.
Their own propaganda inside the China, they early on said that the Wuhan virus will drown that the United States will be drowned in a sea of coronavirus.
And they were right.
There's no question but that they weaponized this and intended for it to be destructive to the Western world and to put themselves in a better economic, military, and political position vis-a-vis the West.
Without launching one missile.
Without launching a single missile, they could destroy us from within, echoing Nikita Khrushchev's warning to America that we will not have to go to war with you. We will destroy you from within.
Yep, as he smashed his shoes on his desk saying, "We will bury you." I remember that when I was a kid.
Yep.
Long time ago. Jonathan, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back for the final hour with you. And that's an hour of phone calls from our incredible listeners. Jonathan Emord with us. His book that's coming out in Feb of next year, The Authoritarians. His website, Emord, that's his name, EMORD.com. Linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. He's also got another book out called Global Censorship of Health Information. He's battled the FDA 8 times now and has won. Back with your calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.